As step by step I found my way gratefully into the peace of the forest, feeling it healing my wounds and offering me a place of belonging. I became ever more painfully aware of that question. What justifies my presence in this peaceful world? What justifies the cost of my upkeep, so disproportionately higher than that of other animals? That question is inseparable from the gift of the moral sense of nature. It is all around me, not as an accusation, but as an unspoken query. How are humans justified? These are the words and the ponderings of one Dr. Erazim Kohak, who is a professor of philosophy at Boston University. And the words come from really this incredibly breathtaking book, The Embers and the Stars. So in this text, Dr. Kohak wonders about the relationship between nature and human beings. It's a philosophical inquiry into the moral sense of nature. Put more simply, Kohak asks us to consider what makes us humans superior, if anything, to the rest of God's creation. I think it's a good question. And the book itself is truly stunning. Now, I know that last week Reverend Carroll preached about the creation account from Genesis, and so I don't have an intention of repeating her or repeating that text, but what I do know about that creation account is that at times it can be used and interpreted in some spheres as a text that justifies our domination of creation. And for today, my friends, I want to push back against that notion a little bit because I think it is dangerous. And so during this season of creation, which is the whole month of September, during which faith traditions, different walks of faith come together to set out to explore and to consider our place in nature and to reclaim the oikos, or otherwise known as the home in the Greek, of God. And I want us to consider this morning more carefully the stakes of our current way of life and its potential impact on the generations to come. Kohak says, humans cannot live at peace with themselves if their God and their God, forgive me, if they are not at peace with nature. Humans cannot live at peace with themselves and their God if they are not at peace with nature. It's page 81. So somewhere in my house, and I went looking yesterday, I couldn't find it, but I know this, somewhere in my house I have this picture of me, maybe all of 2, maybe 3 years old, and it's a fairly close-up photo, and I'm sitting on our front porch at our old ranch house that I grew up in this little dress which my mother had undeniably sewn, I'm guaranteed, I'm assured of this. And in it, I'm holding up to the camera a single dandelion. And I've got these eyes that are kind and that are curious. It's like I'm almost saying to the camera, look at this beauty, Mom. Look at this. What is this? Is it okay that I'm even holding it? And I'm really excited about this thing. Can I share it with you? And what I find most striking about this picture is this innocence, right? This innocence and this honesty that seems to be beaming from my eyes. And it was as if perhaps this might have been the first time in my life that I had come across this yellow novelty, which of course I now know to be considered an invasive weed. But that child me didn't know any different. I had no knowledge of the difference between what is wanted and unwanted in nature. There was no distinction of that. I just simply delighted in this vibrant golden flower. And I wanted to know more. Now I'm going to invite you to pause for a minute, and I want you to think about your own childhood. Who here plucked dandelions? Who thought that was a pretty novel thing, right? Most of us, okay? How about when they transformed, right, and they became puffy? Did you blow all those puffy things out into the air and giggle as they lifted off into the breeze? Absolutely. Was there any sense from any of us that those things were anything less than dandy? No. And think about your own children. Think about your grandchildren, perhaps. Think about children in general. Have you ever watched them explore and interact with nature? Have you ever watched them chase lightning bugs around? Have you ever watched them run down or try to run down toads or frogs? Right? Or jump in piles of leaves? Like, we're almost to that point in the program, folks. Fall is here. Did you ever watch them climb trees? Now, I want you to imagine for a second that those cherished moments and memories that we all hold, that we all just delighted in, I saw it happen in the space in our faces. Imagine those being nothing more than a relic of a time past, long gone, eradicated by things like increasing global temperatures, and increasing water levels and population growth. And it's not my intention to go all apocalyptic on all of us this morning. I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, but there is a truth in all of this. That this is our earth, that this is our home. And Dr. Kohak invites us to consider alongside him today, how will we regard it? What is our proper place in it? And what is the prospective cost of our future if we neglect it? We must bear the responsibility of stewards, daring to make decisions and learning to recognize that there is not only the absolute value of being, but also the relative value of beings in the order of time. From The Embers and the Stars, page 99. Psalm 1 sets the stage for the entirety of the Psalter. It serves as the introduction and instruction for the conduct of a righteous person. It starts right out with distinguishing the righteous from the wicked. So it talks about what it takes to be righteous in distinction or in contradiction to what it takes to be wicked. And part of what it's thought to be righteous is to study always the Torah, or to recite it, as Elaine read this morning. And then there's this imagery of a tree, right? We're talking about a tree that is thought historically to possibly be a reference to a tree that was found in the temple courtyard. And as that tree in that courtyard, you might imagine that that tree was well tended to. It was well watered. It was well nourished. It was symbolic of life itself. And so as such, as this living tree was nourished, it could bear good fruit, right? Which is analogous to the goodness that the righteous person would produce in this text. But there's another level of meaning happening here. So according to biblical standards, the measure of a successful life included two things. One, living to a ripe old age. And two, bearing many children. Okay? So we have the tree that lives to ripe old age and produces many fruits. Fruit that thrives, fruit that endures. And naturally, this isn't the first time in the text that we hear of the importance of reproduction, right? We hear these stories time and time again of legacy and lineage. And even today, we continue to be fruitful and multiply, right? In a world that's now populated with 7.9 billion people. So the question is, can our home, can our earth sustain us? Can it continue to do that? In a recent study conducted by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, also known as the IPCC, 234 scientists from 66 different countries agreed that we are on the precipice of climate catastrophe. Maybe some of you have heard about this study. Their concern is that our home may very well not be up to the task of housing almost 8 billion human beings. So where does that leave us in terms of the prospects of the future of our fruits? Because if we continue to multiply, which seems fairly inevitable, right? We've got to promulgate the species. Then how will we engage with all of God's creation in the here and now in ways that are sustainable and dignified and life-giving? You know, how might we make this move? How might we pivot away from this utilitarian sense and approach to our planet? Kohak is actually pretty optimistic in this regard. And he looks to a gentleman by the name of Emmanuel Radel's assertion that says the following: the truth of being human is to redeem and reclaim, not to destroy. I admit at times that I'm not as certain as perhaps Radel is. But if we're to believe them, if we're to take them at face value and to say, okay, yes, we agree, we're here to redeem and reclaim, then how do we begin to seek to redeem our earth and thus us be redeemed in that process? As we redeem, thus are we redeemed. How do we do that, leaving a legacy for our fruits that serves as a testament to the love and to the good out of which God created our world? How do we do that? Might we be justified, as Kohak asks? Well, he believes so. He says, humans are justified by their ability to do good. Page 101. Now, there's a lot that we could probably unpack and argue there, and that is not where we're headed. But let's just settle on the fact for now that in our Markan text for this morning, that good was happening, okay? Good was happening with the unknown exorcist at the first part of that text. And I love Jesus' response, right, to the disciples, because they're all bent out of shape about somebody, you know, exorcising demons in his name, and he's like, so? Good is being done, so why are we squabbling over this? That's what matters. Good is being done. But as we know, in typical disciple fashion, they struggle with the fine print. So Jesus, in response, he continues to teach them, right? And he picks up where he left off in previous verses. And just so you know, in the previous verses, Jesus had pulled into a fold a small child. He had pulled into the fold a small child because, again, the disciples were squabbling over who's going to be the greatest in heaven. You know, who's going to sit on the right hand, who's going to sit on the left hand, and Jesus is like, come here, kid. We should know that at the time, in Jesus' time, children were considered the lowliest of society, right? They served no purpose or function. They couldn't work, right? The cost was greater than the benefit. Childhood, as we know it today, was a luxury. I mean, it's a luxury. It was unheard of back then, okay? So children were the lowliest, and so this idea of making them first, as Jesus suggests, would have been really radical. But what follows, his whole admonition that follows, is even more so. Because in using this incredibly visceral, right, and poignant language, Jesus warns them, warns the disciples, in what can be a rather confusing and misunderstood text, quite frankly, that hell will be the punishment for causing these children to stumble. Now, I just want to put us in place, okay? And I want to put this in context to remind us about this thing that we call hell. And to understand that in this particular text, hell is an actual place in history. And it's an actual place and space in history. It was it refers to the pit of Gehenna, which was south of Jerusalem, okay? Where it was thought that judgment and condemnation would occur. Okay, so Gehenna isn't this otherworldly afterlife. It's an actual place. So that's number one. Keep that in mind. The other thing that I want to raise up here is that much like in Psalm 1, where there's this deeper layer of meaning in the text, there too, it exists in this text too. And it's not pretty, folks. So following in the style of rabbinic literature of the time, what we're actually reading here is not so much about children stumbling in their faith, which I think is kind of traditionally how we have approached the text. It's much more ominous than that. And I want to tread lightly because this is a delicate subject, but the truth of it is that what's happening here is that Jesus is issuing a series of warnings against male sexual misconduct and the need for discipline. This text is actually rife with euphemisms about anatomy, which I won't go into, and thus makes the text kind of controversial and shocking, quite honestly. And there's a painful reality at play here that I don't intend to speak of further, and I'm sensitive to in our church context. However, I think it's important as we consider these texts to know the fullness out of which they came. But here's one thing I do want to speak to, and I think I can speak to this fairly confidently in listening to Jesus and reading what he said. And that is that Jesus, out of his sense of love and justice, and in his commitment to the elimination of systems of domination and power, is making it very clear that children deserve to be protected. Jesus sees to it in this text that the children, the lowliest of society, are cared for and are placed directly in the center of the coming kingdom. Okay, again, this is a really radical move, you guys. This is a really radical move and situates the marginalized of society at the time as privileged in what is to come. A lot to unpack there. So how does this text relate to this broader conversation around the care of our home and our planet? Well, I think it's pretty clear that Jesus not only wants to make the last first and the first last, but he wants to do so specifically in relation to this text with children. What Jesus is doing here is he's pointing to this grand reversal that is at hand that finds children not only protected, but exalted. They are a part of creation and, as such, are worthy of care and consideration. So what will we do to protect them? Second, in his discourse, his conversation here on the place of children, Jesus is also illuminating the importance of our humility. In other words, when he's dealing with the disciples, he's saying, look, don't be concerned about your titles or your prestige or your situation or your image. We're not going to be concerned about those things when the kingdom comes. That's not what we should be concerned with. Rather, a la Micah 6:8, we should be concerned about humble service. And in this case of creation, this means to serve our earth with reverence and care. It means to serve our earth with reverence and care such that we might leave something left for the fruits of our love. Jesus reminds us that we are not called to dominate or exploit others or our natural resources in the name of human advancement or progress. I think Jesus, in an indirect way, asks us to rebuke policies and practices that serve to do further damage to our environment while contributing to the excesses of our desires. And in all of it, we should do so with an eye towards the future for our children's sake. Our children who are the fruits of our trees and considered the least of these, what will we leave behind? What kind of world will we leave behind? And so these are the stakes this morning. So while Kohak, in all of his optimism, which I deeply appreciate, contends that we are justified because we are good and because we can do good, the question is, will we? I'm going to read this little section for you. He says, in truth, as beings whose being is projected into temporality, we humans can claim no status more special than the raccoons, the porcupines, and the woodchucks we slaughter with our motor cars. The good of which we are capable in the order of time may be quantitatively greater, but so is the evil we in fact do. So there's no doubt that we can do great evil. And there's no doubt that we were created in the image and likeness of a loving God. And there's no doubt that we can do immense good. So the question is, beloved, which will we choose? Will we choose, as the psalm suggests, will we choose righteousness or will we choose covetousness? Will we choose the wants of our present or the needs of our future? And as we consider our children, what about their fears, their hopes, their dreams, and their desires? Will we protect them? And will we seek to find harmony within all of God's creation, porcupines and all? You know, I was doing a little reading, and it turns out that dandelions have incredible health benefits. They're edible. Did you guys know that? They're edible. And the leaves can be made into a wonderful tea. So even the dandelions, the weeds, they're not just some invasive species to be uprooted and discarded. We found a way to redeem them, and the question is, will we redeem the rest? Will all of creation be justified? Will we be justified? And as Kohak says, it is up to us. Amen.